everything was gonna be all right. At least, that's what he said, the Duke. No one knew where it came from, but they knew who it was coming for. Them. All of them. And it was already there, among them. The Red Death. No one knew how it spread, but they knew how people died. First, you started experiencing pain in your stomach. Then, you became dizzy. Then, you bled out of your pores. A half hour from when they first started showing symptoms, the people were dead. The Duke had appeared in town after the first month. They were in this together. He would see them through. He was calling all the winemakers, millers, farmers, and the like to bring all their goods to the city. They would distribute everything so that people wouldn't need to do anything. Given how quickly the disease seemed to spread and how quickly it killed, this shouldn't take more than a few weeks. But he would see them through this. He was their Duke. And for the following months, the people saw the carriages arriving at the castle at all times of the day and night, bringing bread, wine, meat, everything they would need to see this disaster through. The Duke said he was bringing in the nobles from all around the kingdom, the best people to advise him. And over those months, the people saw all manner of grand carriages making their way into the fortress at the top of the hill, the old abbey. One night, a lone traveler approached from the village. Crossbows trained on the tiny form, the men on the wall yelled for the person to turn back. Now, they'll be shot. It's a child, the Duke said, having been alerted to the person approaching from the village. And he was right. It was a child, a small girl in rags. She couldn't have been more than 7 or 8. Her cheeks were streaked with salt. Lower your weapons, that's an order, the Duke said. And the soldiers on the wall obeyed. He approached the young girl and bent down. Oh, my dear, what has happened? The girl was out of tears. She said, her mother and father, her grandparents, they were gone. The Duke swallowed hard. That pain must be indescribable. He was so sorry. Was she alone now? The girl nodded. She had no one. Not anymore. The Duke nodded back. Well, that wasn't true. But the girl insisted that it was. Everyone. Everyone was dead. The Duke looked her in the eyes. No. He was telling her that she wasn't alone. He gestured up to the castle. This would be her home now. The girl couldn't quite believe it. It was like a fairy tale. What? The Duke nodded. She would come to live with him. He would adopt her. She would never be alone again. The girl thanked the Duke. The man nodded. He only asked for a minute to go inside and prepare a room for her. She beamed. Yes, of course, anything. She saw his smile as the door closed, and she knew everything was gonna be okay. When the door closed inside, the Duke turned to the closest soldier. All right, weld the door shut. They're starting to come up from the town. Not another person enters this fortress. The men nodded and got to work. You, the Duke said, pointing to another soldier. Go up to the walls. Tell them to shoot anyone who approaches on sight. They should have enough crossbow bolts for twice the number of healthy men, women, and children in the surrounding countryside. The man grimaced. What? No, the soldier said. These were people, his people. The Duke was supposed to be helping them. He had all the food, wine, medicine, meat here in the castle. He was leaving them to die. The Duke pursed his lips. You know what? He respected the soldier's resolve. Speaking up, that took strength. If he didn't want to follow the orders of his Duke, though, he could leave. Now. The man walked over to the door, then stopped. Oh, no. They just finished welding the door shut, didn't they? Ah, no matter. There were other ways out. He whistled. 2 men of his own personal guard appeared. They had better weapons, better armor, and they were better fed than the local garrison. The Duke pointed to the man. This man here wished to go join, what was it, his people? But the door was welded shut. Let's honor his request. Throw him from the ramparts. The men picked for their loyalty and their willingness to carry out any order, no matter what, nodded, gripped the soldier by his arms, and dragged him away. The Duke snapped his fingers, and the men of his garb produced a mask and cloak. He put them on and threw open the doors to the great hall. Inside, a blue light bathed the partygoers. We'll talk about that more in a second. But there was wine, feasting, clowns, dancers, musicians, beauty, and pleasure. The cacophony of beautiful sounds meant that no one heard the scream of the soldier or the thud when he hit the ground outside. The Duke turned to one of the members of his guard. Well, what was the man waiting for? Get him a drink. It was party time. I'm Jason Weiser from Bardic. This is Fictional. The Duke held up his hand, and the orchestra stopped. The courtiers and nobles stood in rapt attention. He said that it was done. They were completely safe now. The kingdom's best would see this through. Let not another word echo in this home about the outside world. There was no outside world. Only them. Inside here, there was no pestilence, only pleasure. And it was folly now to grieve or to think. So he raised his glass, and the room followed. To beauty, to wine, to security within. Without, the Red Death. The rest drank. The room started chittering away, resuming their conversation. 1,000 people were spread across the abbey. The quote-unquote best in the kingdom. Most were in 6 of the 7 great rooms, enjoying the food and clowns and dancers and fools. Others had found and occupied some of the bedrooms. Still more were taking the Duke's exhortation to not grieve or to even think by practicing drowning themselves in the wine cellar. There was enough for 10,000 in the old abbey. After all, the people, well, the people wouldn't miss it. Not in a few hours, that is. Then the clock struck. The laughter faded. The music stopped. The booms echoed from the black room, the 7th great hall. The brave merely pursed their lips and paused whatever activities they were engaged in. The others grew pale and looked to the floor, waiting for the chimes to stop. 2 men, barely men, they were the sons of one of the nobles, were coming up from the wine cellar, and their laughter echoed in the blue hall, competing with the chimes. The Duke stood, the crowd parting before him, and when he reached the men, he slapped one across the face and drew his dagger, putting the point to the neck of the other. No one spoke during the chimes. The young man with the reddened face, peeking through the broken mask, nodded, trembling. The other, hands up, had blood starting to drip from his neck. They started to say they were sorry. It wouldn't happen again. But the Duke raised his hand, shaking his head. Not until the chimes finished. When the chimes were done, the Duke sheathed his dagger, and the conversation began to trickle around the room. The Duke said he had very few rules here. This was a place of pleasure after a difficult few months. But the next time they spoke during the chimes, the next time anyone spoke during the chimes, they would find themselves joining the others hanging in the courtyard. The people swallowed and nodded. The Duke smiled, and they all smiled back. As you can probably imagine, the Duke, having been raised in luxury, believing that he was better than the world by virtue of his birth, and being denied no desire, no matter how twisted, well, he was a strange one. For this masquerade, where the nobles drank and feasted and indulged in every debauchery they could imagine while the world died around them, the Duke had transformed the abbey. There were 7 large rooms in the castle, each illuminated by a different color, Blue, purple, green, orange, white, violet, and red. The first six were a curiosity and charming. Light beamed from behind colored glass, and the people enjoyed conversations and entertainment, I guess because a green clown is so much better than a regular colored one. The last room, though, the black room, well, no one went in there. No one, that is, except the Duke. Everyone was allowed, but it was bathed in red light, and it reminded everyone of the Red Death. It was a joke too off-color for the people that left the world around them to die. At the back of the black room, in the red light, sat a clock made of ebony, whose chimes the whole party had to stop and observe. The tastes of the Duke were particular, but they could be adapted to. Besides, after watching the pestilence and death creep closer and closer to their estates over the past months, the people were more than willing to observe a moment of silence once an hour, and a weirdly red room, if it meant reprieve from the Red Death. The people they left back home were already dead. No reason they should follow the rabble to the grave. The masquerade itself followed the Duke's eccentricities. There was beauty, of course, but there was also a grotesque nature to it. There was glare and glitter and delirious fantasies, the glow of goddesses and the terror of a phantasm. And so, the party descended. The revelry kicked free of its tethers to reality of life and death, morality. It was like a waking dream. Everything was possible. Everything was permitted. They were pulled from the dream once an hour, when they were forced to pause for the chimes of the clock in the red room, only to revel in the descent anew when they were allowed to continue. Then it was midnight, the shortest chime. Someone spoke. The Duke rose, dagger in hand and head swirling. Who dared? It wasn't one person. It was a dozen. Then two dozen. They all parted at the back of the blue room and stepped back, gasping. Pushing aside his guests, the Duke's dagger flashed in the blue light, and he saw it. There, in the middle of the masquerade, was someone who had taken the invitation's suggestion of a grotesque costume and elevated it to the point of tastelessness. Even in the blue light, they could see the red of the mask. It was a face contorted in pain and horror, specked with blood coming out of its pores. It was the costume of someone dying of the Red Death. The people were disgusted. Here was not only a reminder of the Red Death, of the pestilence that swept their land, but of their guilt. How, right now, while they stuffed and gratified themselves, the people who had earned and made all the food and wine were dying. They had the Red Death, and the people in this abbey had stolen from them and left them. The Duke, though, wasn't remorseful. He was angry. This costume was a step too far. It had ruined his party. "Stop him," the Duke boomed. "He'll hang for this," and pointed the dagger at the man. But no one moved. No one would move. Whether it was because the costume reminded them of the disease or reminded them of their guilt, no one wanted to get close to the stranger, wet with what they could only assume was blood. The tasteless, horrifying mask nodded and dipped from the blue room without resistance. The Duke followed the trail of blood, and even though he passed through the purple, green, orange, white, and violet rooms, the blood always appeared to be red. The Duke had to keep his bearings as he stormed through the rooms. The wine, revelry, and rush of colors made him feel like he was tumbling through a dream, but always, the blood kept him rooted in reality. There was someone who shouldn't be here. This was his house, his world. He decided who lived and died. Finally, it was the end of the line. The black room. The blood seemed to leap out at him in the red of the room. This interloper wasn't running. He wasn't cowering scared. He was merely standing in the middle of the room, waiting. Like he had always been waiting. The Duke gritted his teeth. His party, his dream had been turned into a nightmare, and it was all the stranger's fault. He staggered closer. Hanging was too good for this one. The Duke raised his dagger above his head, and it clattered to the floor. The Duke followed, thudding to the stone. He wasn't moving. He was dead. The people who had been following at a distance, out of morbid curiosity, stood shocked at the edges of the black room. The stranger stood in the center, unmoved, with the crumpled form of the Duke on the floor in front of him. The Duke's guards were the first people through, and the guests, emboldened by the charge, rushed to the one who had killed the Duke. Sure, the Duke was creepy and more than a little unhinged, but he had saved them from the plague by bringing them here. A dozen hands gripped the stranger, tearing off the mask and ripping away the bloody robes. And when they did, the mask and the robes fluttered to the ground, revealing nothing. There was no tangible form behind the mask. It was nothing. The people looked at each other, chills beginning to run down their spines. Wait, what was going on? Then they began to feel something other than chills. Deep, shooting pains in their abdomens. They started screaming out as, for the first time, they noticed the Duke on the ground. They noticed the blood on his face. From the pores. The trademark signs of the Red Death. An hour later, when the clock chimed once, the Abbey was silent, but not by choice. Their revelries now had truly ended. Hundreds of people were drenched in every color of the rainbow, and though most never made it out of the rooms, some had burst through to the entryway, only to find the iron doors, all the doors, welded shut. Their attempts to stop the rabble from coming in hemmed them into a prison of their own making. The brave few jumped and flew from the ramparts like the soldier, but no one made it to the town. As the chime died, so did the torches of the castle and of the town, with no one left to tend to them. All stood dark and still as a tomb. The story ends by saying that the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. Fun story, right? Now, a popular pre-2020 interpretation of the story is that rich or poor, healthy or sick, powerful or not, we are all mortal. The Duke tried to wall himself up against death, against consequences, in a hedonistic nightmare paradise of his own making. And not only did it not work, it hastened the only thing he feared. I think the message now is more relevant than ever, that no one is invincible. We have to look out for one another, help one another, because we are all in this together. There's another story today, another Edgar Allan Poe story, and you're going to know it as soon as I start. So here we go. Fortunato danced and swayed with the crowd. It was Carnival time in his Italian town, the festival right before Lent. And Fortunato was feeling good. Like, get so loaded that you dress up like a jester and dance all night in the street good. The more Fortunato drank, the better he felt. And it certainly helped him forget about his cough. He staggered through the streets, weaving in and out of the conversations, before he had found the smiling face of his old, old friend, Montresor. The man looked stone sober. Huh, they would have to fix that. It wasn't Lent yet. The man warmly embraced Fortunato, and yelled something above the shouts and the music. He had to say it 3 times for Fortunato to hear him. But then, Fortunato caught the word, and Montresor had his full, drunken interest. The man had secured a cask of Amontillado. At least, he thought it was a cask of Amontillado. He had bought it at the carnival, which was weird enough, and he didn't have Fortunato's insight into Spanish wine. He said he should have consulted Fortunato first. He paid full Amontillado price, but he had his doubts. Fortunato studied himself on the brick wall behind him. Amontillado. Montresor said that he had to know for sure. He was on his way to Lucchesi's place right now. Fortunato shook his head. Lucchesi was an idiot. He couldn't tell Amontillado from sherry. I'll go. Montresor cocked his head. Isn't Amontillado a type of sherry? Never mind. No, he knew Lucchesi was available, and Fortunato was having fun. Fortunato said that this party was getting lame anyway, and Amontillado! Ah! Fortunato, swaying, grabbed Montresor by the elbow and started heading to his house, to his vaults. Mainly because he was excited to help out his friend and see if he got a deal, but also mainly, Amontillado! Montresor smiled again and said that Fortunato was too nice, but no. He had that nasty cough, and the vaults were far down into the catacombs, under the river. It was too much for him right now. Stay here, have fun. I'll call on you in a few days to come try it. Please, I insist. Fortunato shook his head. It was really nice of him to be so worried about his health, but he would help his friend. Montresor smiled. All right, twist his arm. Let's go drink some awesome wine. Fortunato threw on a mask and started to dance, but almost took out a table. Montresor took his friend's arm, and they both ambled toward Montresor's home. All right, so where is it? Fortunato asked, looking at the various casks and bottles. They had just walked through Montresor's empty house. Montresor was a good guy. He gave all of his servants the night of Carnival off. Paid, no less. Oof, Fortunato shivered. Montresor wasn't joking. The catacombs were cold. Montresor patted his friend on the back. Just a little farther in, he said with a smile. They stopped here for... Yep, there it is. He snagged a bottle from the shelf and popped it open, while Fortunato steadied himself on a cask. This will help keep us warm down there, he said, taking a swig and passing it to Fortunato. Montresor took a torch from the wall, one no doubt lit from when he and his servants brought the barrel down to the catacombs, and the pair started their walk. Fortunato could feel his cough coming back, and the blanket of inebriation being pulled away, the stench of mildew mixed with dust, and the remains of countless generations of Montresor's family meant that he had to drown out his coughing with more of Montresor's wine. Feeling warm, they walked for minutes, and Fortunato took a drink to guard himself again from the cold and the dripping rocks all around him. He took a drink for the honored dead, shut up in the catacombs all around the pair. Fortunato guessed he must have said something out loud, because Montresor replied that his family was extensive. The drunk man thought about it. It was a little embarrassing. He couldn't remember what the man's coat of arms was. Oh, yeah, it's a foot, Montresor said. Well, it's a foot in a blue field that's crushing a serpent's head whose fangs are embedded in the heel. Oh, cool, Fortunato replied. What was the motto? Nemo me impunile sit. No one attacks me with impunity? Fortunato translated. Huh, cool. Your family have some problems early on? They must have, right? Montresor replied. All that retribution stuff? The Middle Ages were crazy, though, so who knows? Montresor stopped in front of him. He apologized to his friend, saying that this was a bad idea. He had forgotten how far down he kept the good wine. They were underneath the river. The water trickled among the bones here, and it was really bad for Fortunato's cough. They should forget about it tonight and come back when the man is feeling better. No wine is worth making him feel worse. Fortunato guffawed. He wasn't going to die from a cough, and on the contrary, a sip of Amontillado after a long walk was going to make him feel pretty great. Until then, he said, and drained the bottle of wine that they had had with them while walking. He made some sign with it, and he could see Montresor cock his head in the torchlight. Oh, sorry, yeah, you're not a mason.
No, yeah, I am,
Montresor informed him.
What?
I literally never see you at the meetings, Fortunato shot back, and asked his friend for a sign. Montresor nodded. Of course. He pulled a trowel from his robes. Fortunato lost it and staggered back a bit, needing to steady himself again. That's a solid joke. It's a lot of commitment to carry a trowel around with you at all times, and it really requires that specific setup, but totally paid off. Great job. Montresor laughed and snagged another bottle from along the walls, popped it open, and passed it to Fortunato. It helped the chill in his bones. The torch in front of Montresor hissed and popped in the catacombs as they passed under the arches and descended, walking a bit further and descending again. Finally, they were looking into the bleakness of a deep crypt. On the closest wall, bones from, I guess, the less honored dead were simply piled up. Fortunato grimaced. He reckoned someone forgot to add Barry Grandma to their to-do list. Fortunato coughed again. Montresor told him that the Amontillado was just in that little alcove up ahead. He'll find a place to put the torch so they can get started on the wine. Montresor let the second wine bottle clang on the stones below and staggered into the barely lit alcove. The darkness was nice. It was hard not to close his eyes as he felt along the craggy stone wall. The alcove was deeper than it looked. The 1.5-ish bottles of wine that he had had in the last half an hour in full effect, he had to stop to rest. And his thoughts started to flow together. Hey, Montresor? Fortunato slurred. Can I get that light? It's really dark in here. Then he felt it. The back wall. Far away from the entrance. When he was shoved to the rocks. And he heard the clanging of chains and the click of a padlock. Oh, good, you're here, Fortunato said. Hey, why didn't you bring the light? Good idea, buddy, Montresor replied, saying that Fortunato should stay right there. He didn't want the guy to fall or something. Fortunato shook his head. He tried to sit down, but something was pulling at his waist and kept him standing. He yelled back, asking where the Amontillado was, but got no answer. He was so tired. It wasn't until then that he heard the scraping, and then he began feeling anxiety welling in his stomach. He tried to move toward the illuminated entryway, but something stopped him. About 20 feet up, Montresor was working on something. Fortunato gasped. The trowel. Montresor was laying bricks at the mouth of the alcove. Montresor was walling him in. The fear blasted away the inebriation. He pulled, tried to run to the doorway, but something held him back. Something cinched him at the waist. He felt the chain, the padlock, and the strong iron staples holding him to the wall. What was going on? He yelled out to Montresor, asking him what he was doing. But the man only smiled and whistled. Fortunato screamed, and it was only then that Montresor looked up from his work with a smile. He said that he had tried to get Fortunato to leave with him, but Fortunato refused. And, feel those walls? Feel how damp they were? Montresor had to wall off this portion of the cave, where he might lose the catacombs and, of course, his wine. This is a joke, right? Fortunato said. They'd have a good laugh about this later, right? The Amontillado, Montresor said with a smile. He was on row 10 now, his head just above the wall that was nearly complete.
Yeah, the Amontillado, but it's getting late, Montresor. Won't they be looking for us up in the plaza? Won't my wife be looking for me? We should go.
Then Fortunato remembered. He had thrown on a mask as he left the festival, and Montresor had only been there for a few minutes. No one knew he left with Montresor. Montresor had given his servants the night off. No one knew he was down here. No one would ever know he was down here. Yes, Montresor replied. We should go.
For the love of God, Montresor!
Fortunato barked and pleaded as Montresor hefted the last brick in place, and the cave went dark. Then, a shaft of light. Montresor was moving the bricks, tearing down the last one with a scrape of stone and mortar. He made a hole again. Fortunato breathed. Oh my gosh, thank goodness. It was a joke. It was all a messed up joke that Montresor had taken way too far. But they would laugh about it someday. Far, far from here. Then, the deconstruction ceased as the torch found its way through the hole, and Montresor's hand dropped it. Then, the final brick pushed the last of the mortar into the room, completing the wall. Fortunato could watch the wall being finished now. Watch the last bits of mortar sloppily tumble to the ground, and watch it dry. As Montresor tracked the path back in the dark, he listened with relish as the cries of Fortunato, the jester in his damp, soon-to-be grave, faded to nothing. So I didn't need to do the Cask of Amontillado, right? Pretty much everyone knows it. The way Poe wrote it, you're in Montresor's head the whole time, like a spider about to eat a fly. But you know what? The type of sociopath who would wallop a man in a crypt and leave him to die, I'm gonna go out on a limb, might be an unreliable narrator. It's an interesting little revenge tale. That being said, we won't tell a story on this podcast if we can't be transformative. And you know what's surprising to me? Fortunato was the nicest guy in the story. When I first read this in 8th grade, I believed that he had done something deserving of his fate, because Montresor told me he did something deserving of his fate. But the quote, "thousand injuries of Fortunato and him venturing upon insult," is no way deserving of being murdered. I thought, for our adaptation, this story would be interesting from Fortunato's perspective. You're out at a festival, having a good time, and then this friend who bitterly hates you, but hasn't told you he bitterly hates you, in fact, he only seems to care about your cold, and that you shouldn't be going down into the crypt sick, mentions that he could use your help, and after many refusals, you still help him. Then, you're completely surprised to be chained to a wall and left to die. And even at the end, Montresor doesn't give any explanation for his actions. He simply drops the torch and leaves Fortunato to die. And from that view, this story is kind of more scary. It's like, you could have a Montresor in your life and not even know it. The Montresor being someone that you trust implicitly until you realize it's too late. That's it for this week. Both stories today were adapted from works by Edgar Allan Poe. Regarding the podcast, I'm still trying to figure out how fictional fits into our workflow. So thank you for your patience with the delay between episodes. I'll try not to have it be this long again. I'm working on a few really big episodes, like things that would usually be about 10 parts, but in one episode. So it's taken a bit longer. But once again, thank you so much for your patience and for staying subscribed. Fictional is by Jason and Carissa Weiser. Our theme song is by the amazing Breakmaster Cylinder. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.